are listening to Radio Albion.
Going to do something that we don't do very often, which is a free question and answer at the end of the show, so you might want to stick around for that. Now, we are live tonight on Rumble and Odyssey. Please do share the links if you can, and if you want to contribute, that would be very, very much appreciated. You can contribute directly to the show via Rumble. You can send in super chats. You can contribute financially via Rumble, and that is super, super helpful if you can do that. And I really, really appreciate it. So if you want to send a super chat, if you want to send a financial gift, if you want to send support, you can. And obviously, the more support, the better. I do really appreciate it. And if you can send something, $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford, that's really helpful. And it goes toward keeping us afloat and making sure we can do all the good work that we do. You can also donate via crypto. All the crypto links are in the description below. And finally, if you wish, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. But as I said, usually we do questions at the end and the questions are just paid super chats. But tonight I'll answer anything for free. So we're going to do a bit of a free Q&A, which can go into the topics that we discussed tonight. But also, we can go elsewhere if people want me to. And I do this occasionally as a way of giving something back, especially when people are being very generous, which they have over the last 7 days. And because of that generosity, this is my way of saying thank you and doing something that allows people who maybe can't afford to donate or super chat to ask a question and to sort of pick my brains on any issue. Now, before we get into the show, and as people sort of trickle in, I just wanted to mention my Substack, because that's a place where you can also help me out. But it's a place where I am regularly publishing new articles. And I have published a new article today called Murdered at School, The Killing of Harvey Wilgoose by Mohammed Khan. And you can probably get the gist of the article from the title. Now, this was massive news when it happened, because when it initially occurred, there was much speculation about who had murdered Harvey Wilgoose. Everyone heard there'd been a stabbing, that a boy had died. It quickly came out who the victim was. But initially, there seemed to be reporting restrictions around the killer, which turned out to be a young man, 15 years old, called Mohammed Umar Khan. And this blew up. There was lots of speculation. Eventually, his name was released. Reporting restrictions were lifted. And the case kind of got forgotten. Now, at the time, I did an article about it that I turned into a video essay that you can still find on Rumble and other platforms. Now, that was a short video talking about the fact another white boy had been stabbed to death, this time at a school. But one of the things I like to do with my Substack is go back and revisit these older articles. And sometimes, you know, what I've written before serves as an important jumping off point or a skeleton that I add to. And sometimes it needs completely scrapping. So I was reviewing the Harvey Wilgoose case, and it's now gone through court. His killer, Mohammed Khan, has been sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum 16-year term. And this particular killing is quite interesting because there are a number of similarities between the case of Mohammed Khan and the case of Axel Ruder Cabana, the Southport killer, but also the case of Valdo Calicane, the Nottingham Spree killer. And if you go and read the article, it's only 5,000 words long. So it's a substantial piece, and I publish two of these every week. You will see that what actually happened here was, again, completely avoidable. And there were more than 130 logged incidents of violence, gang activity, weapon possession, and aggressive outbursts by Mohammed Khan. Yet it was all swept under the carpet, and eventually he went on to stab Harvey Wilgoose to death on school grounds at a school, All Saints Catholic High School, in fact. in Sheffield. So this is a really interesting story, and one, as I said, that's kind of been forgotten, because what really happened around this case, which was sort of necessary but unfortunate, is the government actually named the killer. The judiciary named the killer. He received a sentence. It was all sort of done and dusted, but then it kind of got forgotten. And then there was an inquiry that was kept secret. And this was actually in part, the contents of it was in part revealed, because although the inquiry was kept secret, a copy of it had to be handed to Harvey Wilgoose's parents, Caroline and Mark, via their team of solicitors. And they actually convened a press conference and revealed some of the most damning findings from that report. Now, I've collated all of that and so much more in one 5,000-word article. So if you appreciate someone who is willing to go back and report on these anti-white crimes, these anti-white murders, and catalogue exactly what happened and then put them into context, you want to check out my Substack, because recently I've covered three such stories. One is the case of Chris Donald in Scotland, which is the most violent racist murder in British history. I also covered the case of Jamie Carney, the pro-migrant activist who was killed by her migrant lover, the one she met at a left-wing pro-Palestinian demonstration. He drained her of her money, then beat her to death and suffocated her. And then the latest article is this one about Harvey Wilgoose. And no one else seems to be covering these cases in such detail. So please go and check out my Substack. And again, look, nothing goes behind the paywall. Nothing I do is sectioned off. I don't charge you for anything. There's no sort of fee here. You don't get charged $5 to watch a stream, or, you know, $10 to read an article. It's all for free. And I do rely heavily on people's kindness. But I do it this way so the information that I provide can be shared. So if you appreciate that and you appreciate the lack of paywall, please do consider doing something. And if you can't necessarily do something right now, go over to my Substack and consider subscribing there. It's a very small amount per month, but it really does help me. And if you can be one of those subscribers, that's great. And if you can't, I appreciate you just signing up and reading the articles for free and maybe giving them a share, because I think they're quite educational and I hope you enjoy them. Anyway, one final announcement before we get into tonight's stream. We were going to do a film review with Blair Cottrell on Sunday. Blair had recently watched a film called Mickey 17, and he was talking about it. I said, would you like to come and review it with us? And I actually acquired the film today. I'm not saying how I acquired it, but I did acquire it. I haven't watched it yet. And I was like, let's do this. Let's do this on Sunday night. And Nativist was like, mate, it's the World Cup final. And indeed, it is the World Cup final. And I'm not going to be that jerk who does a big stream on the night of the World Cup final, because I don't think anyone's going to tune in to watch a review about an old film when the World Cup final's on. So, yeah, sorry about that. And next month, we'll be reviewing Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. So that'll be next month. I don't know who we're going to get on for that one, but we'll get somebody. Maybe the Golden One, actually. Maybe he'd like to come on for that. I don't know. I'll ask him and see if he'd like it. If not, we'll get somebody else on. But we're going to move the Blair Cottrell stream to next weekend, because I'm not going to be the idiot that's streaming during the World Cup final and wondering why only 11 people are watching, because it's obviously Sports Ball Central. You know how it goes, guys. Somebody said no one in England will be watching the final. Yes, they will. I'm not sure who I want to win, Spain or Argentina. I can't stand the Argentines because they always make digs about the Falklands War, and the Spanish team aren't much better. So I don't think I'll be watching. Although my daughter did say to me today, Dad, can we watch the World Cup final? So I might sit with her and watch it, because that's what she wants to do. Although I will say this, if I was a betting man, my money would be on. She'll watch about 5 minutes of it, be absolutely bored and be like, Dad, can you read me another chapter of Matilda? Because that's what we're doing at the moment. We're reading Roald Dahl's Matilda. If you're a big book fan and you've got children, I recommend Roald Dahl books. The Witches, The Twits, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Matilda. We've done Fantastic Mr. Fox. She loved it. She knows the song from that. This is totally off topic, isn't it? I've talked for 10 minutes and said nothing about what we're going to say. It's going to be one of those nights, isn't it? But as you can tell, I'm in quite a sort of light-hearted and fun mood. And you can take advantage of that later in the show by asking me questions for free. And VK Gargoyle says Matilda is fantastic. It indeed is. We've just done the chapter about Bruce Bogtrotter, who is forced to eat an entire chocolate cake by the headmistress of the school, the Trunchbull, Miss Trunchbull, to the children. It's a good chapter. My daughter was laughing. We laughed, and she was like, can I have another one? But I was like, no, it is bedtime. And off she went. But it's a good book, and I recommend it. Roald Dahl, a great man. And if you read The Witches, The Witches are a very accurate snapshot of what, shall we say, the Epstein class. That's who the witches are. The witches are based on those people, and they do terrible things to children. That is a very good book, too. And I remember one of my favourites being The Twits, and my daughter's very much looking forward to that. I have all my children's books from when I was a child. My mum boxed them up. She's a big fan of books, so I've kept them for my children. And They're not disappointed. I went through all their old noddy books with them, but now we're doing, and I will with my son when he comes of age for reading books. But at the moment, my daughters are enjoying Roald Dahl books being read to her every night. So yeah, if you are liking this random chat, we can go further with this. And basically, if you want to ask any questions later, be it about Roald Dahl or the stream, you know. Anyway, let's get into it. Clacton by-election, what a circus. Now, there is a very obvious take here, and it is that the Clacton by-election is a complete waste of time. It's utter nonsense. We don't need it. It's a waste of taxpayers' money. It's a waste of time and effort. But there is another take here, and this is probably the more interesting take. So Nigel Farage has been repeatedly attacked because apparently he took a personal donation of £5 million from some young crypto whiz kid. Where are you, crypto whiz kid? Where's my 5 million? but look, he got the donation, 5 million in Bitcoin. That's it. And now it's an issue for the Parliamentary Standards Committee. Well, you know, when it comes down to it, I'm sure all MPs take personal donations. Some of them take large donations, travel to Israel, etc. And no one says anything. So I'm not really going to knock Nigel Farage for taking this money, because all the MPs do it. And he took it off somebody who apparently gave it no strings attached, is a young sort of crypto billionaire, apparently. And he wanted to give something to Nigel Farage because he wanted to see Labour out. So I can't really see the problem there. As I said, especially when so many MPs are regularly going to Israel, taking money from Israeli lobbyists, and nothing gets said. There's no issues. There's no Parliamentary Standards Committee. And in fact, worse still, you have people investigating issues pertaining to Israel who are all part of Friends of Israel groups. So when all that happens and doesn't get investigated, I think the only reason this is happening really is because it's Nigel Farage. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of Farage. I've had plenty of bad things to say about him, or truths to say about him that he might think were bad, but I haven't always been his biggest fan. I've had lots of clashes with him over certain things, but I do think he's quite useful at the moment. I've made all those points, not really going to go over them again now, but I do think it's probably all about the fact that this is Farage. It's not about the fact that Farage has done anything wrong. It's about the fact he is Nigel Farage. And at the moment, he is a threat to the establishment in that he is the only man in Britain who could break the centuries-old two-party system. And we've discussed that at length. So I don't actually think he's done that much wrong. So why is he called this by-election? And why is it on the surface a waste of time? Well, I don't think he should have called it. I think he should have said, look, screw you. The money's mine. You know, I'm not going anywhere. I think that's what he should have said. And I think he should have told the Parliamentary Standards Committee to go stuff it. But he didn't. What he did is he said, look, you're making a fuss about it. You're publicly assassinating me. You're rubbishing me. I've had enough. So what I'm going to do is step down as an MP. We'll have a by-election. And if the people back me, I'll come back to Parliament. And if they don't, I won't. Now, on one hand, yeah, he is wasting everyone's time. On the other hand, he's actually being quite honourable. And when I say he's being quite honourable, what I mean by this is, How many times have we seen the press and the newspapers say, oh, we need a by-election. Oh, we need a snap general election. Oh, something needs to happen. We need to have our say. Well, interestingly, love him or loathe him, Nigel Farage has basically said, well, I'm going to let you have your say. I'm going to let you have your say. If you think I've done something wrong, vote for someone else and vote me out. This is your chance. But if you're happy with me as your member of parliament, as your MP representing you, vote me back in again. And that's the end of it. Now, this might not be the perfect thing, but it is to some degree quite honourable, because Andy Burnham, who just got elected, people are saying, well, why not call a general election? I don't believe he is going to call a general election. There are many cases where MPs are involved in scandals and they just ride it out and they wouldn't give the public a referendum on it. So in that case, it is quite an honourable thing to do. And also, it's not unprecedented. So I looked this up before the show, and in the last 100 years, there's been 24 cases where, similar cases to this, according to Google, where sitting MPs have been criticised and they've stood down for a variety of reasons. And there's generally three reasons why they do this. There's single issue civil liberties protests. And one of these happened recently with the Conservatives. David Davis, a prominent Conservative, he resigned his seat, which was Halton Price and Howden. And he did that as a protest against the Labour government's 42-day pre-charge detention policy for terror subjects. And he won his seat back comfortably because Labour and the Lib Dems boycotted the election. And we're going to come back to that in a minute. So remember what I've just said there. Now, this was really interesting because David Davis was absolutely disgusted that Labour were having this massive extension to pre-charge detention for potential terror suspects. So what Labour brought in was a system where, let's say I got picked up tomorrow for a terror offence, and often political dissidents are picked up by counter-terror. I could be held for weeks without charge. And, you know, David Davis resigned in protest over that to try and raise public awareness. And I'm not a big fan of the Conservatives, but I'd say that was quite an honourable protest. Now, another reason why people do this is defections to a new party. So often, if an MP changes from one party to another, they can do that without a vote. However, some of them, and I'll give you two examples, Douglas Carswell and Mark Reckless, they both defected from the Conservatives to UKIP, immediately resigned their seats, which, interestingly, that was Clacton in the case of Douglas Carswell, and Rochester and Stroud for Mark Reckless. And they said to their constituents, you didn't elect us as UKIP MPs, you were elected us as Tory MPs, but you now have a chance to tell us whether you support our decision. Now, they both successfully won their by-election. So, again, that's quite honourable, because if you're elected as a Labour MP or a Tory MP, then one day you're like, oh, I don't like the way the wind's blowing, so I'm going to defect to the other side. Why shouldn't your constituents have a say? So I think that's another quite honourable reason. And a lot, you know, people have been sort of laughing at Nigel Farage and deriding him over this, but there is a certain, I'm not saying Nigel Farage is perfect, far from it, but there is a certain honour to doing this. And then the final reason for doing this is for the same reason that Nigel Farage has done this, sort of like the people versus the establishment. And this is where an MP like Nigel Farage resigns his seat and says, look, are you with me or are you with the establishment? You know, tell me if I've got your backing, because this is me versus the establishment. And again, there is a certain honour to this. Most MPs who switch sides or protest or get involved in some kind of scandal hold on to their seat, you know, like a man holding on to the edge of a cliff for dear life, so they can keep getting paid and paid and paid until it finally runs out and they either get booted out of parliament in disgrace, or it comes to a general election where they just say, well, I'm going to throw it in now, but I've had enough money and I've rode it out and now I've got my parliamentary pension, so it doesn't matter. So, you know, in a way, despite this being a bit of a circus and a waste of time, there is some honour to this. And there certainly is a sense of, I'm going to give the people a choice. And I do believe in direct democracy. I do believe that if an MP acts in a disgraceful way, that people should get a choice. You know, the people should be able to vote again. And, you know, if you vote for an MP who is standing for party X, and that MP all of a sudden has a change of heart and decides he's going to cross the floor, he or she decides they're going to cross the floor to party Y, why shouldn't the public have a vote on that? You know, so there is some honour to this. As I said, it's not perfect. It's certainly not unprecedented. And I didn't realise how many times this had actually happened before. It actually shocked me. So, you know, I'm pretty well read on British politics. I know how the system works, I know how elections work. I didn't expect this to have happened this many times. And I knew about the David Davis situation. I know it's been done as a protest before, but I didn't know it had been done by so many MPs. And obviously it's happened 24 times in about 100 years. So it happens roughly once every 4 years on average, which, you know, it's not a weekly occurrence, but it's certainly not something you would say was so far out of the ordinary that, you know, you'd only see it once in a lifetime or anything. It's not like England winning the World Cup. You know, it sort of, you know, happens once in 100 years. It happens far more frequently. It happens about the same frequency as a World Cup competition, actually, interestingly. So there you have it. That's how frequent these things are. But obviously everyone's talking about it with Farage. Now, one thing that's very interesting is all the main parties want rid of Farage. Farage is hated by the Tories. He's hated by Labour. He's hated by the Greens. He's hated by the Lib Dems. He's also hated by Rupert Lowe of Restore. But interestingly, none of his critics were willing to stand against him. And I think this is very, very interesting. So, as I said earlier, with the Holton Price and Howden seat, David Davis's seat, when he stood down in 2008 over the changes to pre-trial detention, or pre-charge detention, should I say, for terror suspects, no other party was willing to stand against him. The Lib Dems and Labour were like, we're not doing this, we're not taking part. And the reason they weren't taking part is because they knew they couldn't win. Now, all of these people, Conservatives, Labour, Lib Dems, Greens, Restore, they all throw all of this crap at Farage. And they all want to pull him down a peg or two. And I said earlier, I think that's largely why this parliamentary standards thing is taking place, because they want to pull him down. But interestingly, none of them are willing to actually stand against him. And that's the first thing to note. There has been a mass boycott of this particular election. The Tories won't stand, Labour won't stand, the Lib Dems won't stand, the Greens won't stand, Restore won't stand. They've all walked away from this and said, we're not taking part. They called it a political stunt, etc. But let's face it, it's not really for that reason, is it? If Labour thought they could win Clacton, they'd be standing Clacton to humiliate Farage and take an extra seat. If the Tories thought they could win Clacton, they'd be standing in Clacton. Why? Because they'd be desperate to get rid of the leader of the Reform Party. The fact they're not standing tells you absolutely 100% that no one thinks they can beat Farage. And the fact no one thinks they can beat Farage tells you something about this Parliamentary Standards Committee issue. That they know they can't beat him at the ballot box, so they're trying to get him out and smear him. That's really the only conclusion you can come to. Because if they thought they could beat him at the ballot box and he was unpopular and that his time had come and he was about done, they'd be standing against him and they'd humiliate him. But they're not going to do that. So instead, we've got what is essentially, in my humble opinion, the craziest by-election I think I've ever seen. Now, so far, there are 19 candidates standing. Now, I can't remember ever seeing, in fact, I should have probably Googled this beforehand. I'm not as prepared tonight as I usually am because I've forgotten this, but What is the record for the largest number of candidates to ever stand in a single seat in a UK parliamentary election? So what's the record? The largest number of candidates to stand in a single seat in a UK election is 26 candidates. And do you know when that happened? That was the Holton Price and Howden by-election, which was triggered. And we spoke about this earlier. This is all coming together quite nicely, actually, despite the fact that I missed this bit out. So in the Holton Price and Howden by-election, when the incumbent Conservative MP, David Davis, resigned to contest his own seat against the government's 42-day pre-charge detention policy, 26 candidates stood. So that was the record. The record in a general election is 13 candidates. And this isn't 26, but it is so many that we don't know how many it is yet, which is an irregularity. Now, nominations closed at 4 p.m. today. And usually when nominations close, you know the list of candidates within about an hour of nominations closing. So nominations close at 4 p.m. and usually by 5 p.m. they've been published on the council website. Now, the council in this case is Tendring District Council, and they obviously do have a page about this. And that page, I'm looking at it now, has key dates for the election, download the nomination papers, the official notice of election, Electoral Commission's guidance to help you fill out the nomination paperwork. But as of yet, Tendring District Council have not listed the full number of candidates who are going to be standing. And that's very telling, because what it suggests is there are so many candidates that it's taken more than an hour to compile, and they are still going through paperwork and potentially dealing with the £500 deposits that you have to pay in order to stand in one of these parliamentary elections, whether that's an election or a by-election. Now, the interesting thing is this. Again, Labour, Conservatives, Green, Lib Dem and Restore, they've all pulled out of this. So it's just Reform and a bunch of minor parties. Now, a few people came to me. I'm not going to mention any names, but a few people came to me and they said, Mark, do you think we should stand in this? And I said, absolutely not. I said, if you're a small party, you might think to yourselves, the main parties aren't in this. The main parties aren't in this. This is our chance to shine. This is our chance to come second in a parliamentary constituency election. You know, Nigel Farage is going to win it, but we could come second. And I said, no. Listen to Mark. You see, on the graphic, you might have noticed two people. One of them is obviously Nigel Farage, and one of them is a man dressed as a kind of superhero with a dustbin for a head. His name is Count Binface, and he is at the moment the popular, ridiculous candidate that goes round, stands in these parliamentary by-elections, causes a fuss, and is the joke candidate. But Count Binface is famous for doing something, and that is humiliating political parties. Now, in the last Greater London Assembly election, Count Binface stood, and Britain First, one of the micro-nationalist parties, stood. And Count Binface beat Britain First. And when the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, gave his speech and thanked everybody, one of the things he said is, it's great that Count Binface has stood, because Count Binface has proved what Londoners are really about, because he beat Britain First. So Britain First were beaten, humiliated and shown up by Count Binface. And if you are a party and you want to be a serious party and you want to be taken seriously by the public, being beaten by Count Binface and being turned into a laughing stock is the last thing you want to happen. If you want people to take you seriously, right, you don't want somebody like him to beat you. And Count Binface is not our guy. He might be relatively amusing, but he's not our guy. He's a guy that's embedded in the establishment. He's somebody who is a lefty liberal activist type who actually works for, drumroll, the BBC. So he works for the anti-white BBC writing comedy. And he is there basically to stand in these elections to attempt to humiliate nationalists and other anti-immigration candidates. He loves doing that. And he humiliated Britain First. It made them look fools. They've never really recovered from that electorally. They have some quite good marches. But, you know, once you've been beaten by Count Binface, basically, that's it. The writing's on the wall. And he kind of does that. He collects scalps, as it were. And the guy's awful. But people came to me and said, Mark, do you think we should stand? And I said to people who came to me, don't do it. Don't stand. Don't entertain this. Because although the prize looks tantalizing, Farage wins, our small party comes second, and you can say, look, I'm making this name up, you know, but the British Indigenous People's Party doesn't exist. It's a made up name I've made up. Came second place. And we can now say, you know, the British Indigenous People's Party is the party that can really do it. We're the only nationalist party to ever come second in a parliamentary by-election. You know, that's the prize and that's what people want. But it's a high-risk strategy because, you see, with the other major parties pulling out and it being a race, really, between Farage and Binface, and that's what this is being billed as. You see, Labour, the Lib Dems and others will call on their supporters to vote for Count Binface. And that's how it's being billed in the press. It's being billed as Farage versus Binface. And unfortunately, this should be billed as Farage took the rather courageous path of saying, let's have a referendum on whether I should be in Parliament and whether the public agrees with me or not. All the other parties cucked. Binface steps in because I believe he's an establishment man. And he has reduced this to this circus. He's reduced what was or what could be seen as sort of this noble or courageous, like, I'm taking a stand. I can put my money where my mouth is. Are the people behind me? And he's turned it into Binface versus Farage as a way to humiliate Nigel Farage and as a way, basically, to reduce Farage to a bit of a laughing stock, because that's what the establishment want. He's doing the establishment's work here, make no mistake. And his aim is obviously to take Farage's scalp or to take enough votes off Farage for Farage to be publicly wounded by this particular by-election. But make no mistake, he's out to take other scalps as well. And I warn people, don't stand, because it's going to be Farage first, most likely. Binface probably getting double digits in terms of percentage share, and every other party scrapping it out for the crumbs on the floor. And this could lead to a small anti-immigration or nationalist party ending up, you know, with 100 or so votes and being absolutely humiliated by this lefty liberal BBC comedy writer in a stupid outfit. There you go. So let's have a look who's actually standing, because there is a provisional list. So the provisional list is 19 candidates. And here we go. So the first candidate is Adham Al-Khatib from the Forward Party. Now, I don't know who this guy is, but he obviously didn't ring me asking for any help, and he is going for it. The second candidate is Mark Berger, an independent. There are loads of independents who have taken the bait here. The next is Count Binface. He's actually got his own registered political party called the Count Binface Party. This tells you a lot about the Electoral Commission as well. They regularly turn down nationalist organisations like Patriotic Alternative, but will happily let some comedy clowns stand because the people who work at the Electoral Commission are absolute scum. So there you go. Nick, the Incredible Flying Brick, is standing for the official Monster Raving Loony Party. Now, again, another Count Binface-style comedy candidate. A guy called Cap, who's standing as an independent. Piers Corbyn. Oh, Piers. I really like Piers Corbyn. I've had him on a show before. He was a tireless campaigner against the COVID restrictions. He's somebody that claims that climate change is a big scam. Why are you doing this, Piers? You should have rung me. Please, please don't get beaten by Count Binface, but that's what's going to happen. Rhys Cowan, an independent. Don't know why he's standing. Robert Ells, an independent. There's Nigel Farage for Reform UK, probably the only proper candidate. Another Count Binface. This one's called Mr. Fishmonger. He's an independent. And here is one of the vanity candidates, Lawrence Fox for the Reclaim Party. Now, this clown, he didn't get the memo, did he? He was one of the people who fell for the bait. He thinks he's going to come second. He thinks Reclaim are going to be on the podium at the end. This is probably going to be the end of his political run if he gets beaten by Count Binface. Again, really, really stupid. Should have known better. Obviously, ego got the better of him, got his eye on the prize. But again, it's like bait, isn't it? It's like, you know, when there's a really obvious trap, you know, the cheese is there under the cage and Lawrence Fox is snouting about thinking he's going to grab the cheese, but is blissfully unaware of the trap that's been set for him. So when he gets something in the realms of, I don't know, 140 votes and Count Binface gets 10 times that much. You know, that's his political obituary written for him. You know, Abby Hookway, another independent. Howling Lord Hope, the official Monster Raving Loony Party, which is interesting because it appears that the official Monster Raving Loony Party is standing two candidates in this election. Is that legal? Is that allowed? I don't know, but that's how ridiculous this is. Most of these candidates don't even have pictures. Amy Morris, independent. Derek Norbert Morris, independent network. And the next clown is Kai Stevens for the British Democratic Party. This is the British Democrats. Sigh. God. Oh, God. These guys didn't get the memo. Fresh from being humiliated in the recent round of council elections, they now want another spanking at this election. Now, obviously, these guys are going to have convinced themselves that, in fact, they're going to do really, really well. Ugh, God. Now, British Democrats have been going. I think they were initially formed in 2011, so they're 15 years old. I don't think they've ever won a seat in their entire history. They have held a couple of seats, but only because of defections. Andrew Bronze was an MEP that defected from the BNP to the British Democrats. And I believe that Julian Leppert defected from For Britain to the British Democrats and lost his seat. But they've never actually won a seat. And now they're standing here and they're standing the artist formerly known as Barclay Walsh. I mean, I would say a micro party like the British Democrats, this could be the final nail in a coffin of humiliation. You know, this is going to be probably, you know, they'll probably say, you know, probably come sort of 11th or something, beaten by Count Binface. Again, they've fallen into the trap. John Stevens, Rejoin EU. These guys are complete dickheads. They stand in every election, get about 14 votes. Ridiculous. Baron von Thunderclap is the third candidate for the official Monster Raving Loony Party. which is absolutely hilarious because they've split their vote three ways. Why they've done this, I don't know, but it just adds to the circus that is this by-election. And finally, we've got a guy called Luke Worley, who is an independent. He's got his picture there, so he's obviously stood in elections before. But I think you get the picture. This is a recipe for disaster. And really, it's going to be pretty humiliating. I mean, 19 candidates. If the share of the vote was spread evenly, you know, it's just over 5% per candidate. So it's going to be very hard, really, for anyone to get their deposit back. And you need to get 5% to get your deposit back. And the way I see this going is Farage is basically an extremely popular MP. He did very well in Clacton. He's got a massive local support base. It's been a seat that's been held by UKIP MPs before. It's now Farage's seat, and the infrastructure there will be huge. Farage will also have pumped the entire constituency full of leaflets before he resigned, using his parliamentary communication budget, because MPs have a parliamentary communication budget, which basically means the taxpayer pays for the MPs to be able to write to their constituents once every so many months. And he will have used that budget to its max just before he resigned to ensure maximum impact. He will also have an almost unlimited war chest because he's just been given £5 million by that crypto billionaire. So when you look at it, it would be very unfortunate for Farage not to win. But that could happen because it's also a high-risk gamble for Farage, because if all the other parties act as third parties and help Binface campaign, Farage could even end up getting beaten. I don't think he will, but that's what the establishment are pushing for. There's all these bogus polls saying that Count Binface is ahead of Nigel Farage in the polls. He's going to win and Binface is going to be in parliament. But I can't see that happening. If it did, that would be the end of reform. And essentially at that point, the two-party system would just be completely back in business. Reform would collapse and the Conservatives, who are now seeing a resurgence, would be back where they need to be. So overall, what do I think is going to happen at this by-election? I think it's going to be ridiculous. I believe it takes place on Thursday, the 13th of August. So it's the 17th now. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4. We've got a month of campaigning. We've got 28 days. So in that 28 days, it's quite a tight time scale. Nominations have closed. The candidates will have to design a leaflet, get that leaflet printed, boxed and banded into sets of 100, put into the right postcode boxes so they can be collected and delivered to Royal Mail. Royal Mail will then deliver them, and there will also be a ground campaign. I think most of these candidates will probably mess that up in this tight timescale or won't be able to afford it. Royal Mail will be overburdened. And I'd be very shocked if Farage didn't win. And whilst Farage will likely walk it, there will be a bloodbath for the lower tier candidates. The British Democrats and Reclaim specifically are the ones I'm more interested in because they're anti-immigration parties. I think they're going to be absolutely humiliated, and Binface will claim two more scalps. I'm also a little bit sad for Piers Corbyn because he's a nice guy. I've spoken to him. I had him on my show. I liked him. I liked him a lot, actually. He seemed a very convivial, decent fella. And I don't want to see him humiliated, but that's what this election is all about. And it's sad also to see people saying that they're going to vote for Count Binface. I've seen some nationalists go, if I lived there, I'd vote Count Binface, mate. just a mog Farage. It's like, no. This guy, if you're a comedy writer for the BBC, it's fair to say that you ain't one of us, that you're not the kind of person who's going to vote for border control. You're not the kind of person who's going to vote for deportations. You're not the kind of person who, you know, wants the grooming gangs dismantled. You know, most people at the BBC will absolutely be diametrically opposed to us in every way imaginable. So supporting Count Binface is a big, big no. So really, what do I think will be the outcome here? Well, Farage will likely get back in, but in some ways this will damage him. I think this won't be a good look for him because the others refuse to stand, and it'll tarnish him somewhat. But I think for all the other parties, it'll be absolute annihilation, because it's going to be this two-horse race that reduces the other 17 candidates to just comedy figures. And that's fine for Mr. Fishfinger and, you know, the monster raving loony candidates, but it's not fine for nationalist micro parties. And I keep saying this, and I've done a long article about this, about the micro party problem. You should check it out. It's on my Substack. I push my Substack heavily, but check it out. It's on my Substack. But there is a problem with the micro parties. And basically, the issue with these micro parties is they're not just humiliating themselves, they humiliate the wider nationalist cause. And they humiliate the wider nationalist cause because they're anti-immigration parties standing on an anti-immigration ticket that are getting repeatedly spanked. You know, 19 votes in Hull, 1% here, 0.9% there, 0.7%, beaten by Count Binface in the London mayoral election. It's embarrassing. It makes us all look stupid by association. When our views are being voted down like that, we all look like a bunch of chumps. And I don't know why the British Democrats and Reclaim are entering into this humiliation ritual. You know, the English Democrats sidestepped this wisely. UKIP sidestepped this wisely. Britain First, after being spanked by Count Binface before, wisely sidestepped this election. And that's what needs to happen. You know, if we can't do well, if we can't wipe our face, if we can't at least get close to retaining our 5% and getting that deposit back, we shouldn't bother. Otherwise, it's just a humiliation ritual. But check out my article on Substack about the micro parties. I lay all this out. So that's really my take. People should have walked away from this. They didn't. I think the British Democrats and Reclaim have been really foolish, and they're going to end up looking very silly. And look, backing away from this for a second, I said earlier, rejoin EU. Rejoin EU stands in every election and gets a derisory vote, you know, 0.1%, 0.2%. Do we laugh at them? Yes. Do we say they're irrelevant because of that? Yes. Do they look like idiots? Yes. So when nationalist parties get that kind of level of support, do we look like idiots? Of course we do. It's time to think carefully. It's time to think tactically. You know, Farage really shouldn't have done this. Despite the slightly honourable nature of what he's done and the fact he's given the public a choice and said, look, I'm going to let the public decide whether they want me rather than some rigged parliamentary standards committee. Despite him saying that, he's opened himself up to what is this circus-like humiliation. But there was no need for any of the other nationalist parties to also open themselves up to this. What do they have to gain? They're not going to win the seat. They're not going to save their deposit. All they stand to do is to lose and lose harder. And I don't understand this about nationalists, why we are so committed to entering into these humiliation rituals, making ourselves look fools, and then wondering why the public aren't joining us in droves. Well, the public aren't going to join you if you get a crap vote. That's how it works. I hate to tell people this, but this is basic psychology. In the late 90s and the early 2000s, everyone supported Man United. All over the world, there were Man United supporters, clubs and bars. You could go to bloody Thailand or Cambodia And you'd be walking down the street and they'd be, what? A Man United bar in Vietnam? Well, yeah, because at the time, Man United were the biggest football club in the world. They had this great team of youngsters that came up through their training program. Alex Ferguson nurtured people like Paul Scholes, Ryan Giggs, David Beckham, brought up this amazing team of youngsters, many of whom were British, and they went on to win the treble. They went on to dominate the Premier League, and everyone supported them. Everyone wore Man United shirts. And then when Alex Ferguson left and Man United stopped winning trophies, what happened then? Well, there are still Man United supporters, but not everyone's wearing the shirt. Their star dwindled. It dimmed. Why? Because they weren't winning. People support winners. They support people and organizations that look like they're successful. Success breeds success, and winning attracts support. Conversely, losing brings both ridicule, but it also drives people away. If success attracts people, failure drives them away. And I've seen this. I saw this in the BNP. When we were winning council seats, everyone said they were, oh, mate, I'm getting involved. We're coming down, big events, massive summer festivals. As soon as the BNP stopped winning seats, people left. It was over. That's how it works. And what I'm saying is fundamentally, this whole thing is basically just a bit of a clown show. And it boggles my mind why any nationalist party, any of these micro-parties would involve themselves in this, especially considering the age of people in the British Democrats. Most people in the British Democrats are people who are older than me back in the BNP day. So, you know, they must be in their 50s, 60s, maybe 70s now. But they're still committed to making these same mistakes. Look, if we're ever going to go anywhere as a movement, we've got to learn, we've got to adapt, we've got to evolve, and we've got to think of new ways to reach people that don't involve making absolute fools of ourselves in these thankless tasks, in these ridiculous circus by-elections. That's my take. So there we have it. Anyway, we've got one super chat, and if anyone wants to ask me questions in the chat, I will answer questions for free for as long as they come in. We've had one $5 super chat from Megawatts80. Thank you so much. Said, if the UK has been under Jewish control for 200 plus years, as is suspected, is there any political solution? Well, yes. Yes, there is. And this is something that always gets me. People say, is there a political solution? Well, what is a political solution? Now, is there a parliamentary solution for ethno-nationalists? And what I mean by a parliamentary solution is, can ethno-nationalists win a majority in Westminster via the route of a UK general election? Most likely never, no, especially not with changing demographics. But politics is much broader than just Westminster elections. You know, there are so many groups in Britain that campaign for so many different things, and all those campaigns are inherently political. Pressure groups are political. Lobbying groups are political. You know, you could say AIPAC in America is obviously a political group, yet it has never directly contested a single election. Now, I'm not saying we're going to be the next AIPAC, so we don't have that kind of money or institutional support. But I think it's important to note that there are other ways. Look at our Support the Political Prisoners campaign. That is political. Look at our demonstrations, our banner drops, our conferences. They're all political. Look at our Help the Homeless outreach. That is political because we're out there helping people who are 99.9% white British. And they're on the streets. There is a political solution, but I don't think that solution for ethno-nationalists is the parliamentary route. However, I've said it before, and I'll say it again now, we should hope that a party like Reform, even though they're far, far, far from perfect, could be used as a wrecking ball to smash the two-party system. My personal preference is community building, advocacy, and activism. And we should couple it with something like the Woodlander Initiative, ensuring that we buy land, build communities, and aim to have safe places for us, our children, and for Indigenous Brits who are racially aware. That is deeply political. Anyway, let's see if there's any other chats. Reactionary traditionalist said, nice stream, Mark. I have great anxiety over New Zealand with the immense demographic replacement. The situation is so dire. Whites are a minority in so many cities, what with mass immigration and the Kiwis leaving to Australia. Do you know any Kiwis? And if so, could you bring them on your show? We have had people from New Zealand before. We've had Action Zealandia. They were very friendly with us at one point. I don't know if they're still active. They were young lads. They were doing something that was a bit more like White Vanguard, who are also nice young lads. And, you know, when it comes down to it, I think although places like Britain and America are in much, much worse positions because of the amount of immigration and how long mass immigration has been going on for, places like Ireland, places like New Zealand, smaller countries, which on the surface are more ethnically homogenous and more European, might actually be lost to us more quickly than places like England, France, Germany, and America. Because in a country like Ireland, where there's about 6 million people, you only need a very small number of immigrants in order to completely swamp the country. I mean, look at under the worst year in British history for net migration, which was under Boris Johnson, we took in 944,000 permanent residents. Now, in England, where there's about 70 million people, that's still a lot. But can you imagine that many going to Ireland in a single year? It'd be almost a sixth of the population. And I think that's why places like Ireland, places like New Zealand, could well see this catastrophic shift even before the likes of England. Because although they are late to the party in terms of mass immigration, because they have a smaller population, it can all take place so much more quickly. It's the same with Scotland. At one point, Scotland was probably the whitest part of the UK, but recent statistics suggest that Scotland could be changing demographically now even quicker than England because it is so sparsely populated. When you have these tiny populations, let me just check this again. I'm only fact checking because obviously I didn't know what exact questions I was going to get. What is the population of Scotland? Population of Scotland is just 5.5 million. So again, they're one of these countries that have taken on this nonsense of being a sanctuary nation. The SNP are flooding Scotland with immigrants and doing everything they can to attract coloured immigration. Well, when you've only got 5.5 million people in your country, you let in sort of just over 500,000 per year. What is it? It's 10% of the population. I mean, it's crazy. And Scotland is sparsely populated, so they could expand their population quickly. And the SNP, that's meant to be the Scottish National Party, has this policy of stating that you are Scottish if you live in Scotland and identify as Scottish. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So there you go. Are there any other questions? If you want questions, it is free. You can ask them. We've got nearly 200 people watching. I'll give you a few seconds. I'm not going to sit here all night if no one wants to ask, because I can go and grab a shower and have a nice cool drink and chill out. Or we can go for a bit longer. But it's certainly up to you if you want to do that. You know, anyone that's got anything to ask, either about Clacton or about any other issue, can. And no one seems to be asking questions. So we'll have a bit of a countdown. And if people aren't, somebody said, thoughts on James Fishback in Florida. I'm not sure who James Fishback is. Let me just have a look. James Fishback. Let's have a look. Early life. I'm doing the early life check. Well, it doesn't. He doesn't say he's one of them. What's he standing for? What's he standing for? I don't know. Well, it says he's being targeted for being anti-Semitic, so I would certainly be interested in seeing what he has to say. Let's put it like that. If he's being attacked for being anti-Semitic, I'm going to go and read up on him. But obviously, I can't do that live on the stream. Greenius Saximus asked, have I checked out the Fabian Society? I know about the Fabian Society. The Fabian Society is a very clandestine movement. It basically aims, well, it's, for a start, its logo is a wolf in sheep's clothing, which tells you pretty much everything you need to know. It's one of these sort of clubs or movements or organizations which involves left-wing MPs and left-wing sort of opinion formers, captains of industry, important individuals who wanted Britain to be transformed into sort of a socialist republic or some kind of a communist state, but knew they couldn't do it openly. So the Fabian Society exists in order to get people into positions of power through mainstream parties and mainstream channels, whether that be hard power in terms of being an MP or whether that be institutional power like a lecturer at a university or a captain of industry or, you know, the head of a important part of the church. And all of these people will have sort of communist belief systems. And that's the way they take over. It pretty much goes hand in glove with the notion of the long march through the institutions, which is, of course, a left-wing sort of communist liberal plot to get people with highly progressive anti-white views in positions of power. And this has largely worked because these people now control the police, they control the army, they control the educational institutions, they control social services, and they are heavily overrepresented within Parliament. And the Fabian Society is just part of that. I have looked into them. Utter scum. The people involved in subversive groups like that should really be charged for treason because they are working against this country. But they do so quite openly. If a right-wing group was involved in the kind of activity that the Fabian Society is involved in, I think it would be treated as some kind of terror threat, quite simply. How do you think the murder of Anne Widdecombe will affect the Clacton election in terms of left-wing behaviour and milkshakes and such? I think Anne Widdecombe was obviously murdered by a leftist or somebody who was converted to a foreign religion. And I think that because although it's being dealt with by terror police, I think it's pretty obvious that the establishment don't want to tell us what's motivated this. Now, look, if Anne Widdecombe had had her head smashed in by a guy, you know, got pictures of Hitler on the wall and a copy of Mein Kampf on his bookshelf and, you know, a giant Third Reich flag above his bed, we'd all know about it by now. But all we've heard in the mainstream media is that the guy was obsessed with left-wing literature and had, you know, communist stuff in his house. And then it's kind of been dropped and forgotten and people don't really want to talk about it. I think had this been the other way around and had Anne Widdecombe, as I said, been a left-wing MP and had she been killed by somebody with, you know, Third Reich memorabilia in his house, we'd know about this and it would be weaponized in this by-election. But it's not being weaponized really in this by-election because of the fact the media don't really want to cover it. The BBC won't want to cover something like this because it tells you really where the violence is coming from. And I've been involved in politics 26 years, and I can tell you the vast majority of all political violence comes from the left, simple as. Probably the next group that it comes from most is immigrants. Immigrants and the left is where your political violence comes from. It very rarely comes from white people and nationalists, although being on the receiving end of a lot of this violence are the ones that sadly get the blame for it. I would say that there will be increased scrutiny against people who are making jokes about this, who are trying to attack candidates, and the fact that the police have sort of doubled security around notable reform spokesmen and spokeswomen tells you everything you need to know. This was probably motivated by a hatred for Reform, Nigel Farage and Widdicombe. You know, there have been rumours online that the killer had a list of notable persons of interest within Reform, and he was going to go on some kind of spree killing. But again, the right doesn't really weaponize these things or capitalize on them as well as the left would. If you look at the way Joe Cox's death was weaponized, you know, before the Brexit vote, the right would never do such a thing, and that's to our detriment. Unity is crucial. It's about time nationalists stop calling people they don't agree with retards. Does that mean, well, I mean, you know, I'm not really sure what that's aimed at. I mean, I do believe in nationalist unity, but I do think it's retarded to stand in this by-election. So it's kind of hard to discuss it, isn't it? Because I've praised people for not standing in this by-election, but I can't, with any good faith, say it is anything other than utterly retarded to fight this by-election. So, you know, that's it. There we go. Sean Not Seen said, Mark, how do we keep our kids away from the invaders? I think this is going to be a controversial thing to say, but I do wholeheartedly believe it. I believe in looking after your kids. I believe in myself personally. I want to look after my children. I don't want to separate them from the worst excesses of the multicultural progressive society. But at the same time, I don't want to cut my children off from it entirely. I think it is very, very dangerous for people to completely insulate their children from the dangers of a multicultural society and a progressive society. Now, I'm not saying go out there and throw your children to the wolves, definitely not. But imagine if you brought your kids up in an idyllic little village, you know, on an island off the coast of Scotland, and they were schooled with three other sets of children and brought up in a traditional way. And one day your kids were like, I want to go to London. Well, it would be a completely different world, wouldn't it? It'd be the equivalent of, you know, little green men abducting you in a flying saucer and dropping you off in a city, in a bustling city on an alien planet. You'd be like, where am I? What is this? I don't understand. It would be completely mind-blowing, and I don't think you'd be equipped to deal with it. So what I'm saying is, I do think we should protect our children as much as we can, but we shouldn't wrap them in cotton wool. I think it's important that your kids, you know, for want of a better term, have some kind of inoculation to the multicultural society and understand the threat it poses. And I don't think you can truly understand the way the world works unless you've experienced it. And most of us who are here today and hold the views that we hold these views because of our lived experiences. So I'm definitely not saying, you know, chuck your kids in at the deep end. What I am saying is they at least need to dip their toe in the water to understand that there are threats out there. So by all means, you know, protect them, educate them, look after them, and separate them for their own safety. But don't wrap them in cotton wool to the degree that they will then be emotionally and mentally disarmed when they face the horrors that actually are out there. You know, that's really sort of how I feel about that. Harry Hurst said, if the UK had joined forces with Germany, they would still have their empire and be an economic powerhouse. Do you agree, Mark? Harry, I've written an extensive article about this very issue, about Britain going to war with Germany and how it was the greatest mistake Britain made and how it led to the sun setting on the empire. In fact, it's on my Rumble. Let me just give you the, since you're kind enough to be in the chat, I've actually answered this question pretty extensively. Let me bring up the actual video. So if you go to my video section, and it's somewhere, it's not the most recent of videos, but it's also not the oldest. Where is it? Britain should not have gone to war with Germany. 11 minutes, 10 seconds, 2 years ago. And the the picture is a German soldier throwing a stick grenade. I'll dump the link in the chat for anybody who wants it. Check it out, and you can see what you think. There you go. So Horatio Hornblower said, any PA collaborations with the Woodlander? There will be. I asked him to come on the show a couple of weeks ago, but he was away on business. Always love working with him. He's a real gentleman. Many of our members are also members of the Woodlander group, and I fully endorse everything he's doing. Got any film reviews in the pipeline? Looking forward to Apocalypse Now with Tom Sewell, if it's still on the cards. No, Tom sort of disappeared. He's working very hard at the moment on their legal challenge against the Australian state, and I'm not really going to drag him away for that. But we do have two film reviews coming up. We're doing Mickey 17 with Blair Cottrell, not this Sunday, but next. I did book him for this Sunday, but I have to tell him that's off because it's the World Cup final. And we are going to do The Odyssey, Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey, in a couple of weeks' time, which will be sort of like mid next month. I think that's what people really want to see. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the show. That's all the questions. I haven't seen any more questions. Question, does Rumble take a hefty cut of super chats? I think it takes 20%. So there you go. But you can donate multiple ways. If you want to donate, there hasn't been many donations tonight, and that's fine. But if you want to donate, you can do so via Rumble or Substack. And, you know, you can do that now. You can do that now. You can go over, do that now. It's very much appreciated. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. If you do that, it makes a great deal of difference to me. One more question. VK Gargoyle, what do you make of the 3-year sentence for Vikram Digwa's mother today? How can Gurpreet, the brother, not be charged considering his lies and perverting the course of justice? Well, I think Vikram Digwa's mother getting 3 years for removing the weapon, I believe. Let me see what she was actually charged with. What exactly was Vikram Digwa's mother found guilty of? So she was found guilty of assisting an offender. So the actual charge was assisting an offender. Was her 3-year term typical or lenient? Just asking Google. So, under the Criminal Law Act 1967, the maximum penalty for an assisting an offender when the underlying crime is murder is 10 years. Her 3-year sentence utilizes less than a third of the statutory maximum. Unlike many offences in England and Wales, there are no definitive sentencing council guidelines for assisting an offender. Judges must assess the specific gravity of the assistant and the defendant's culpability on a case-by-case basis. In his official sentencing remarks at Southampton Crown Court, Judge William Mousley KC balanced the extreme seriousness of our actions against extensive mitigating factors. Wow. Okay. Are we doing this, guys? Are we doing this? Because if people want to extend the stream, we can do this. Because her sentencing remarks have just been made public. Would people like me to go through the full sentencing remarks, and we can either wind ourselves up and get mad, or we can say it's a fair sentence? What do you think, guys? Shall we do it? People are saying, please do. Her name is not Poojeet. It is not Poojeet. Although I am laughing that you've said that. That's kind of joke my daughter would make, by the way. Thanks, Poojeet. Yes, my daughter thinks everything is funny if it has the word poo in it, because she's 6 years old. So the sentencing marks are only 5 pages. So you're getting, this is why I'm a good guy. You're getting good value for your £0 and 0 pence super chat. So here goes. Let's see what it is. I've got it up, so we're going to see how angry we are. Her name is Kieran Kerr. It's not Digwa, her last name. So here it is, the sentencing remarks. I hope you can see this. I'm going to read it in full because it's only 5 pages. Henry Novak, aged 18, died on the 3rd of the 12th, 2025. He was a much-loved, kind, hard-working and ambitious young man devoted to his family with a bright future. He was a first-year student at Southampton University, the first in his family to go to university. He was careful and principled, full of humour, warmth and promise. Your son, Vikram Digwa, murdered him. He was 22 then, and he is one of your 5 adult children. What have I said about these people? You are 53. Mark Novak, Henry's father, Lucy Ross, mother, David Stevenson's stepfather, and Katie Woodcock's stepmother have described the devastating and lifelong impact of Henry's death on the whole family. This seems very brief. This seems very brief, almost disrespectfully so. But you've got to remember, this is taken on the back of the longer sentencing remarks for Vikram Digwa and the actual murder of Henry Novak, where the judge fleshed this out more significantly. So I don't think this is actually disrespectfully short. This has already been covered by the same judge. Not long after 11 p.m. on the 3rd of the 12th, 2025, Henry Novak was walking back to his university accommodation in Portswood, Southampton, after the evening out. His route took him north along Belmont Road, and he was approaching a junction with St. Denis Road, where you lived with your family. Henry was not drunk, but may have been affected a little by the small amount of alcohol he'd consumed over the previous few hours. He was not a regular drinker and did not generally drink to excess. His blood alcohol level at the time of his death was below the legal limit for driving. He was alone and unarmed. Your son happened to be walking along Belmont Road on the same pavement. It was to be a chance meeting. Well, this is just sort of a summary of what's happened. Your son was carrying a large Sikh dagger in a sheath attached to a belt over the outside of his clothing. It is a strict requirement of the Sikh faith to have a knife. Here comes the cucking, called a kirpan at all times. Generally, this will be a small knife hidden from view, often on a length of cord and worn around the neck. He had that, but in addition, the large dagger in a sheath on full display. Your family are a member of an order of Sikhs called the Nihang, who have a tradition of having a second knife that is often fully visible, believing that the guru will look favourably on that. Your son observed that tradition in everyday life, at work and in public. Like, you've got to say this, okay? If people are coming here and they've got some wacky religious belief, which means they have to carry a knife at all times, why are they even here? I mean, if they want to do that, fair enough if they're in their own country. This is absolutely sickening. Absolutely sickening. The privilege extended to practicing Sikhs of being allowed to be in public with a bladed article, and particularly in respect of the large dagger, a highly dangerous weapon, easily accessible to the wearer, brings with it huge responsibility. This is very similar to what he said in his other sentencing remarks. It is a fundamental principle of Sikhism that any kirpan is worn as a symbol of religious faith and is never to be carried as an offensive purpose. The legal approach to the carrying of such a knife, as long as the blade length does not exceed 9 inches, is that an offence of having a bladed article in a public place will not be prosecuted. There has been an acceptance that its possession in those circumstances can amount to a good religious and therefore legal reason for having it. The blade of the knife will not be on display. Either it is under clothing or alternatively in a sheath. For both, it is a religious and consequently legal requirement that a kirpan should only be used offensively as a last resort. Why they're even allowed to use it in any means is ridiculous, because it gives them a massive advantage over everyone else. And if so, reasonable in the circumstances. It is obvious that for use to be reasonable, any perceived threat justifying its use would only be in circumstances of great seriousness and urgency. You would have been fully aware of that. Well, would she? Would she? We've come to why she might not be. In Belmont Road, your son and Henry passed each other. There was an interaction between them. Henry, perhaps cheekily, made a comment asking if your son was a bad man. Henry was filming on his phone when he said it. The tone of his voice was not aggressive or threatening, but, as it turned out, a tragic error of judgment. It is a reasonable conclusion that the comment was because he had seen the large sheath dagger. That would have been very unusual for most people to see. Your son went towards him and confidently told him he was a bad man. The exact events which immediately followed were only witnessed by Henry and him. However, it would not be unreasonable to conclude that Henry would have wanted his phone back, believing it had been stolen from him or even robbed. That may have led to a physical struggle. Your son drew the dagger from its sheath and, as the jury was sure, deliberately stabbed Henry in the chest with it. The knife passed through clothing into the chest. It passed upwards through soft tissue between the two uppermost ribs, catching a lung and cutting an important vein behind the collarbone. This was to a depth of 8 centimetres from the skin surface, and consequent bleeding flowed into his chest cavity. The pathologist, Amanda Jeffrey, found 1,200 millilitres or over 2 pints of blood there. She said that no emergency medical treatment would have permitted access to the bleeding vein. In simple terms, he would not have survived, however quickly he received first aid, CPR or expert medical treatment. Henry was also stabbed twice to the upper leg at some point and once again to the lower abdomen groin area at the front. The latter only resulted in a knife tip injury. The former were both substantial depth, though not as deep as the chest wound. Henry's face was also slashed with the blade of the dagger. Henry was never able to put up his hands to defend himself from further serious injury. Your other son, Gurpreet, arrived on the scene very shortly after the attack had finished. Henry was filmed desperately trying to get away. Your sons, both of them, showed a callous disregard for his well-being, making more films of Henry suffering and ignoring much of his desperation at having been stabbed. They told him that had not happened, no doubt to convince others who were nearby. Henry was meanwhile clearly going downhill very fast. They lied to the police that Vikram had been racially abused and assaulted. By then, you and your husband were at the scene. Your son, Gurpreet, explained that no weapons had been involved or were present. In fact, whilst he was talking to the call operator, Vikram told you to take the murder weapon, sheath and belt away. By then, you knew or believed that he had stabbed and injured Henry. Even if you might have believed that your son had been racially abused and assaulted, you knew there could be no justification for him to have stabbed Henry. Your son had no significant injury. A responsible parent would have challenged their son over their actions and encouraged them to do the right thing. Instead, you took the knife home and put it with a larger collection of ceremonial and other weapons in your son's bedroom. That would have helped to conceal what it had been used for. This was because you wanted him to avoid being caught. You then returned to the murder scene. Your behaviour in Belmont Road before and taking the dagger away added to your son's pretense that he had done nothing wrong and that he was the victim. So far, this is actually quite interesting. And I've got to say, the judge has been quite forthright, but one thing that sort of shocked me is how involved Vikram Digra's brother Gurpreet was, yet no charges were brought against him, despite an obvious attempt to pervert the course of justice. But anyway, we'll continue. Once the police had a better understanding of the likely events, you, your husband and your son were all arrested near to the scene on suspicion of attempted murder. You were later arrested for the offence with which you were charged, prosecuted and convicted. You denied guilt whilst in police custody and continue to do so. You were detained in custody for several days. The large dagger was found in a search of your home and the police were later able to confirm that it was the murder weapon, but not for about a week after Henry's death. A responsible parent would have helped the police identify the murder weapon and you had several opportunities to do that. There is no definitive sentencing guide. Now, this is the important bit, and we learned this earlier, but let's do it anyway. There is no definitive sentencing guideline for the offence you committed or for any other similar offences. I apply the general guideline. The maximum sentence is 10 years custody. There is no Court of Appeal sentencing guideline, but there are sentencing judgments, some of which have been drawn to my attention by the parties as examples of appropriate sentencing for the offence. Their combined effects to be that there is a range of custodial terms from 2 to 6 years, although every case of this sort is fact-specific. Now, I'm going to stop there and give my perspective. If you assist an offender, there are differing degrees of assisting the offender. How much did you assist them? Were you egging them on? Did you drive them to the scene? Were you like the getaway driver? Did you help them plan the killing? you know, assisting an offender. There were multiple grades of this. Now, obviously, she turned up after the fact. She was in no way involved in the murder, and she assisted in a cover-up by removing the blade, but did not directly assist the offender in any premeditated way. So I think that is how the judge is going to assess it. I haven't read this, but that would be my guess. I'm not saying that's how I would judge it, but that's what's going to be my guess. But let's see. Of the five purposes of sentencing, the focus in this case should be on punishment and the reduction of this sort of crime by deterrence. Based on the facts, culpability and harm were both significant. Your role in this group activity was under the direction of others, but it did add to the degradation of Henry being arrested when he was dying. You had no previous convictions, and there is evidence of your otherwise positive character. You had a hard life in India, although that improved when you married and came to the UK nearly 30 years ago. You are embedded in your Sikh community, but speak little English. You have a number of significant health problems. Your actions, mistakenly to protect your son rather than for any personal gain, and you are very unlikely to reoffend. When you are released from prison, you may have to make very considerable changes to your way of life and living arrangements. You have been in prison for more than 7 months. This is very interesting because he seems to be taking into account the fact she's old, has medical problems and can't speak English. I'm not actually sure why her lack of ability to speak English has any say. You know, if you kill somebody, does it matter if you can't speak English? You've still killed, you know. I get fatigue sometimes reading this stuff. Do you guys get fatigue? I'm feeling the fatigue. The shortest commensurate sentence is 3 years imprisonment. There is no appropriate alternative for community punishment and rehabilitative work within the probation service. One question remains. Must the imprisonment be immediate or can it be suspended? I must balance factors in favour of and against suspension. There is a realistic prospect of your rehabilitation with or without probation support. Continued imprisonment will have a harmful impact on others. However, the seriousness of your offending requires you to be punished, and others who might find themselves in a similar situation to be deterred from doing as you did. That outweighs the factor in favour of a suspended sentence. It follows that immediate imprisonment is the only appropriate sentence. Stand up, please. The sentence is 3 years imprisonment. So what he's basically said is this is extremely serious. It needs to be a deterrent. And although he's sure she won't reoffend, she had a clean criminal record, she can't speak English, and she's elderly with health problems as mitigating factors, he gives her 3 years out of a maximum of 10. He then says, you'll be entitled to release from prison when you have served a specified part of that term. The precise release date will be calculated by the prison authorities, who may also decide to consider earlier release with a home detention curfew. And Sam Melia didn't get that, did he? You will then be on license for the remainder of the sentence, subject to recall to serve more or all of the time if you commit another offence or break license conditions. The period you have spent remanded in custody by the courts will be included in the calculation of that release. So you now spend, I believe it's 5 months, roughly 5 months in custody for every year that you're sentenced to. So as she has been sentenced to 3 years, she would logically serve 15 months in jail. She served 7 of them, so she would have 8 more to serve. Now, I've got to say this. I find that quite irritating reading that, because they've obviously made allowances for the fact she can't speak English, which is enraging. And they've also talked about a home detention curfew, which again is terrible. The fact that she might be released almost immediately just to be detained at home is ridiculous. I mean, imagine that, you know, oh, look, Mark, we're sending you down for 2 years because we don't like you and you said something on a stream, but we're putting you on home detention curfew so you can sit and be with your family. That'd never happen. That would never happen. But for her, you can see the judge was quite sympathetic. He gave her the lowest sentence he possibly could. You know, although there's no sentencing guidelines, that low sentence was obviously due to the fact that she was from this ethnic minority background, couldn't speak English, was embedded in her Sikh community and had a hard life in India. It's just so exhausting. I mean, really, she, you know, obviously she had a clean criminal record, and that is a genuine mitigating factor. But balanced against that, she was done for assisting an offender who had committed murder. You know, I look at it, and although I would say I would have expected her to get, if it had been a white guy, I'd have expected somewhere between 4 and 6 years, maybe, for that kind of offence. I would be surprised if it had been a minimum sentence for a young white male. But it was the minimum sentence for her. I think we could have expected that. But the fact mitigation was because she didn't speak English, absolutely shocking. But it doesn't surprise me. Somebody said, will Tommy protest the verdict? Probably not. She needed an interpreter in court too. Yeah, 3 decades of living in Britain. She can't even speak English. Ugh. I'm going through getting the last of the questions. Oh, we've got an incredible, generous super chat there. We'll do the rest of the super chats now. So thank you. Thank you to those who have donated so generously tonight. That really does mean a lot. And thank you for the incredibly generous super chat that's just come in. We'll read those out. So the rest of the super chats are Sean Not Seen gave $5. Thank you so much, said Mark. Your content is great. Keep up the good work fighting for our people. Thank you so much. Greenius Saximus gave $10. So thank you so much. VK Gargoyle gave $5. Thank you so much. So thank you for going through it. Appalling sentence. Henry's family were very upset. God bless them and God bless Henry. Well, if you support Henry and his family, please join our White Lives Matter Henry Novak protest on the 8th of August. Full details to follow, but you can share the details that have been released. They're on my Telegram. Horatio Hornblower 1 gave $5 and says, let's do it, Mark. Well, we have, and I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you've enjoyed my take. And Connor Goble gave $100. Well, thank you for that incredible generosity, my friend. I can't thank you enough. And he said, please, everyone watching, go read Mark's excellent and in-depth Substack articles. Well, thank you so much for saying that, and thank you for the very, very generous super chat. That means a lot. And yes, the Substack's all there for free, but if you want to subscribe to me, please do. And look, I've just released a new article on Substack today. It's there for you, waiting for you now. It's called Murdered at School, The Killing of Harvey Wilgoose by Mohammed Khan. And I'll give you a little brief excerpt from this. 15-year-old Harvey Wilgoose was stabbed to death at school by a boy with more than 130 recorded incidents of violence, gang ties and weapon offences. Why did multiple state agencies turn a blind eye? Well, I think you can guess, but it's a 5,000-word article and one that I hope you enjoy. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the stream. We've asked all of the questions. One final thing I will say is I think it's disgusting that Gurpreet, Vikram Digwa's brother, has got away with this. And I think looking at the lenient sentences that Vikram Digwa and his mother got, and also taking into account that the police and the CPS refused to charge Gurpreet, and finally taking into account that racial aggravation was never brought up, despite Vikram Digwa repeatedly weaponizing race at the scene of the crime, this is a scandal, and it's something that disgusts me. And on August the 8th, I will be there protesting this and saying White Lives Matter. So stay tuned for more details on that. Anyway, I would like to say I'll be back on Sunday. I won't, because the football's on and I know no one's going to watch during a World Cup final. But thank you to everyone who tuned in. Thank you so much to all those who donated so generously. And we did do a free Q&A and people still donated generously. So thank you so much for that. And if you guys like the free Q&As on these issues, or you like these more free flowing streams where I just sit here and talk and we cover numerous things, I'd be more than happy to do them again. Anyway, I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. I'll be back on Wednesday, hopefully with Kevin Deanna from the US for Patriotic Weekly Review, but won't be here on Sunday because of the dreaded football. Anyway, thank you so much. I love you all. I'll see you all again soon. Have a great weekend.